Greetings, travelers!
Greetings, travelers. We're in Monster May.
Monster Mayhem continues. Yes,
You
we
keep
are.
saying mayhem. Is it Monster May or Monster Mayhem? Because
Well, it's the mayhem of Monster May.
okay, that's way too many. No,
Too
you're
many
not bringing
M's.
that back. We're not
I'm
bringing
Mark Muncy, so I have to have M. All the
that. That is
M's.
not a thing. It is really not a thing.
Hey, that was my favorite thing to do when Disney opened MGM Studios before it was Hollywood Studios. They had this little 3D audio thing you could do, and you put the headphones on, and they kept telling you know, you were going to be visited by the big cheese, MM. And I was like, oh, that's me. And it, of course, it turned out to be Mickey Mouse, but I was like, yeah, I'll just pretend.
Wow, your ego knows no bounds.
What it's all about, baby.
Okay, well,
So.
since we're in Monster May with Mark Muncy, you see
Yeah.
how I did that just for you?
There you go.
That
I
made me
appreciate
sick a
it.
little bit. We have a guest today.
Yes, we have an
So
amazing guest.
we have an amazing guest that I don't think you actually officially introduced me. I think there was a aligning of the stars,
Now,
or
we were doing a panel, I think.
no, I
Was
met
that,
him before
you
the
met him
panel.
before that? I just remember the panel where I roped him into a panel on, we were reading from our books, and I roped him in because he had a new book that came out, and
Yeah.
then he didn't have it with him, so I had him read from Roger Zelazny's Night in the Lonesome October.
Figured out a way to bring that up, did you?
I will always bring that book up. One of my favorite books of all time. So,
I know that because you made me read it and made me do videos every day of reading it. So I'm very well aware. And now, per our listeners, next year we have to read it aloud. Wah! Okay. But let's get to our guest, Mark, that you're being weird over. Do you
oh
want
yeah,
to
sorry, sorry. This is a amazing person who I've had the pleasure of working for a couple times, working with a couple times, and hanging out with not nearly enough times. This is the creator of many of Halloween Horror Nights icons, as well as a creative director for several theme parks. And if you love Halloween and you love monsters, he also directed the wonderful Monster Kids documentary, as well as the Jaws, the shark is still working, the amazing James Michael Roddy.
Hey guys, how are you? So I was waiting for It's Monster May with our main man, the mysterious, magnificent, mesmerizing Mark Muncy. Derek
I
Lance.
am choking on the ego that he emanates when people do crap like that. Like,
Oh well, you know.
boom. There we
I'll
go.
tell you, somehow he's going to manage to bring up Euro 13 in this episode. You'll see. Watch, it'll be magic. It's amazing.
Now I
He
gotta hold
may have
it.
reached out to me before this and hedged his bets.
Yep, we scheduled it. We got it
And
ready
now a
for
dramatic reading.
of Euro 13 by Robert Zelazny. No, that's not
No,
accurate.
Roger Zelazny did other things. Bureau 13 was written by Richard
Oh
Cijulka.
my God, that's not the point. That is not the point, Mark. Okay.
And here he is.
That would be amazing because he's been dead for a few years. That would be incredible. We would have
Well,
talking to the afterlife. So
it is eerie travels,
that's
so
true. We've done weirder.
that's true. I'm going to do this because Mark's not lovely guest that has joined us. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background that Mark didn't already allude to?
Oh, Erica, what would we do without you?
I have
Your
no idea.
calm, kind of just maternal yet authoritative expression of keeping us in line, which when we've been around you, we know when you step out of line, which is hilarious. It's very odd. But no, thank you, Erica.
Wow. Wow. This
Wow.
is going to be the shortest episode we've ever had. Oh.
And
And
goodbye.
that was James Michael Roddy.
Yeah.
Thank you, everyone.
See you
Don't
next
forget, we'll see you
time.
on the other
Yes. See you
side.
on the other side. Yep.
See you on the other side, Ray. So, thank you for having me on the show. I'm a big fan of the show, obviously. I'm a big fan of both of yours. I am a monster kid. That's the best way to describe me. I'm a monster kid. I love horror. I love fantasy. I love asking what if all the time. I'm a believer in cryptozoology. I love myths. And somehow, you know, my passion for that as a young man and growing up, I turned that into somewhat of a career and had a lot of great opportunities to do some really cool stuff. I worked for Universal for several years, and it's just kind of like a checklist of nerddom. I played Peter Venkman and Ray Stantz from the Ghostbusters. That was one of my first jobs at Universal, and, you know, chasing ghosts, which to me today, the fact that I got paid for that for about a year of my life is the best thing ever.
I also love the fact that you could tell people, what was your job? Well, I'm a Ghostbuster.
I do. I don't you think I don't? That's, you know, chasing class five, full torso, free roaming, vaporous apparitions about in the back lot of Universal Studios was something that's very cherished to me. At the same time, I also played Dudley Do-Right, which was another thing that was from my childhood that I loved. You know, I never really liked Rocky and Bullwinkle, but I loved Dudley Do-Right. But even so, I was more of an underdog kind of fan. Those were my favorites. But I digress. So, you know, I started in the theme park world in Orlando in 92, 93. Before that, I was a professional actor. Before that, you know, I did everything I could to tell stories. There was a movie that came out many, many years ago. Well, actually, tomorrow, we're filming this the beginning of May. So yes, this will have aired after that. But the beginning of May, May 1st, was the official, 50 years ago, tomorrow was the very first shot that they took on the beaches of Martha's Vineyard of Jaws. Tomorrow morning will be the 50th anniversary, 50 years ago, which is awesome. Anyway, you can cut that out.
No, we're not. We're leaving all that in because
Jaws is a great monster movie.
Well, Jaws is really a combination of the classic monsters, Jaws and Star Wars, and the disaster movies of Irwin Allen and all the great TV, you know, things like Dark Shadows, Night Gallery, Twilight Zone, along with a magazine called Famous Monsters of Filmland, and the comic books of Marvel and DC, all of that combined to warp young Michael Roddy, who was born in 1968. It warped him through the early 70s. It was a great time where there were things like Night Stalker was actually on TV. You had watched it week after week, see what monster there was. And then, you know, those things, as I grew up, I was always living in that world of like, ooh, what if? And then Star Wars came out, which blew everybody's mind that saw it originally. And then a movie called Close Encounters. And at the same time, Mark, which you know, there was a resurgence in spiritualism and paranormal and things that go bump. There was a little haunting in a place in Amityville that swept the nation. There was a movie called The Exorcist. All of that was happening at the same time, kind of fanning the flames of my interests. So, you know, the first thing I did when I knew I wanted to be a storyteller in some capacity, the easiest way to do that is use yourself, right? I would draw and I would act things out. Then I said, okay, I'm going to become an actor. At the same time, I would write all the time, but I was like, I'm going to be an actor. And I did that for several years and I never got thrown off stage, which was good. But
well, then you weren't doing it right. No, just kidding.
Well, that's for a different podcast. But the coolest thing is when I started working at Universal, they had an event team that was putting together things like Halloween Horror Nights. And so my interest and my fandom, and I dare say, I don't want to use the word expertise, but I grew up as a walk-in encyclopedia of classic horror, you know? And so I played Norman Bates my very first Halloween Horror Nights out by the actual Psycho house that they had in the motel that Mick Garris used for the fourth Psycho film.
Yep.
And then the next year, the next year I was still an actor at Universal and I came in and they said, oh, we're not going to have Norman Bates this year. But would you be interested in doing some writing and some voiceover and stuff for us? And I was like, absolutely. And that just kept going and going and snowballing to where in about 3 years time, I was on the creative team for Halloween Horror Nights. It was a very small team. And then some of those people left and I became the creative director for Halloween Horror Nights and created some really cool stuff with a great team of people like Mike Aiello and David Hughes. And we did, you know, we created Jack the Clown and the Caretaker and these icons, because to me, that really was what you needed to kind of push the envelope of here's the intensity that we're inviting you to. It's going to be scary, but in a fun way. And you wanted to put a face to the event.
I wanted to, okay, I need to ask a couple questions. I know you're talking about yourself. So my first question on that, because that was one of the first things you told me, which blew my mind, because going to and getting thrown out of Halloween Horror Nights, as we all know.
Oh, so you did it right.
I always do it right. It's I don't run, I don't freeze, I attack, regardless if I know they're actors. It's fine. It's fine. I'm not allowed in. I know my limits. But one of the things I think is very interesting about Halloween Horror Nights, because a lot of places followed suit. And then, of course, there are a few sort of standalone haunted houses. But I feel like a lot of that, when it first started, was finding a movie or show reference and doing a haunted thing off of that. You know, you talked about Norman Bates, but mm-hmm. then you guys developed these characters that literally became more famous than some of the horror movie characters because of how scary they, but they weren't linked to an actual like previous existing media.
That's absolutely right. And what I forgot to mention is before Universal, while I was working as an actor there, I was hired by a man named David Clevenger at a year-round haunted attraction in Orlando, downtown Church Street, called Terror on Church Street. And that showed me that, okay, this, you know, you hear about Grand Guignol and French theater and horror theater and things like that, but it showed how you could take a group of people and move them through scenes, through scenes, through scenes, telling a story and scare the hell out of. So that was something that I put in the back of my brain. So, you know, you're absolutely right, though. A lot of things were based on IP. And luckily, Universal has a lot of horror IP. So that usually was, I think that was probably the case of why they even started doing Halloween, is they're like, you know, there's so much of our history that's rooted in horror. The Fab Five, if you will, of Frankenstein, Dracula, Wolfman, Bride, Creature, Mummy. But then beyond that, you know, there's Psycho. Then there's some stuff in the 70s. Jaws is really hard to pull off as a haunted house, but they had an attraction. So they kind of, some of their horror offerings later on were not as available and not as well. The stories didn't really resonate. The movies weren't, like The People Under the Stairs was a maze in the very first Halloween Horror Nights. How many people have seen that movie? I know.
That movie scared the shit out of me. But sure, anyway,
sure.
At that time,
but it
wasn't a huge
hit. 2024, do you really remember that movie? Is that like one that rises up there in the pantheon? I mean, again, I think it was Wes Craven, right? So it's got all the right cachet. And also, you know, things like Freddy Krueger, Jason Voorhees, some of those, Michael Myers, obviously, there wasn't such the litigious nature that there started to be in the 90s, the mid-90s to the 2000s, where people said, you know, estates started popping up for people that had been long dead. Films that were in catalogs were suddenly like, wait a minute, there's money to be made from these properties. We, even though we're not making sequels, we own these. So if anybody uses them, we should get paid. So it was during that time where suddenly Freddy Krueger couldn't be Freddy Krueger. And you couldn't hear the Nightmare on Elm Street music or say, 1, 2, Freddy's coming for you. He became Razor Blade and Jason became Hockey Killer. And even though it was kind of like a, we all know what we're doing, that really bothered me. Like, I didn't like that. So I started trying to come up with, well, let's create our own stuff. And, you know, Jason Voorhees is very specific to that story, but there could be another hockey masked killer or a chainsaw maniac that's not, you know, the Sawyer family from Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So we started infusing that into the scripts and the stories, and it took, right? People were like, oh, these are great. And then the backstories to each of those mazes became more and more, as a writer, you create a Bible, which you guys know of, here's what's happening. And with that, that Bible had full storylines of these great characters that there was no movie. That was coming from our imagination and things that we were like, wouldn't it be cool if, you know, what we took it as our opportunity to make movies, even though we weren't filming it. It was like, what would we do if this was a movie? And then, you know, my thought about maze design has always been, you create, here's the story. the fully developed story that's very rich, but then where is the guest entering in that story? So you don't tell a maze from in the beginning we did this, and you don't tell a through line like that. You tell that all as the backstory before they ever enter the maze, whether it's the logo, it's the cue video, it's the synopsis. So when you start going through, it's like, it feels more personal because it's like, I am now part of this movie. I am now part of this story. It's, you know, like if I were doing a Psycho maze, I wouldn't show you Norman killing his mother and mummifying his mother and all. I would say, you're checking into the hotel. I mean, similar to what they did, right? You check into the hotel and then it's her story and then she gets killed and you're like, wait, what happened? And then you find out all this other stuff. So that really is what the switch started happening in the late 90s. And then 99, you know, up until that point, they really didn't have a face of Halloween. It was like, well, Halloween's Halloween. And it was becoming very much generic. Like they had these things that they would say were icons that basically for merchandise, a little gremlin pulling an eye back or a skull, which are cool iconography from Halloween, but have no storyline attached to it. And they were trying to figure out, how do we sell and grow our audience and sell this to a consumer or a guest saying, here's what this feels like. Because up until that point too, Halloween didn't really have an intensity to it. It was like, oh, it's another event. It's like, well, you want to tell people that it's scary and intense. So we were at a what do they call it? The meetings where they, a group of people get together and talk about what scares them. And we were watching these people. Oh, focus group. That's what it's called.
I was like, you just described a meeting. You're like, it's a meeting where people get together and talk. And I'm like, you just literally described a meeting. So that's cool.
Yeah, no, it's I was still searching.
Group. And for travelers, if you don't know what that is companies will put people together and watch them talk or watch them interact with their product to see if what they thought was happening or what they believed people wanted is what they want.
Which characters stood out to them when they watch a pilot and stuff like that. Yeah.
So we were at this focus group and there were a lot of the same questions of, what do you think about this? And what do you think about Frankenstein's monster and Dracula? And, you know, and again, the people in the room, all walks of life, some knew who Dracula was. Nobody, you know, it was very eye-opening because you're like, what do you mean they don't know who Bela Lugosi is? What do you mean they don't know? But I just sat there and I'm drawing, and because I always draw when I'm in a meeting and I just kind of think it helps me take information in. And they said, what scares you? And, you know, it was the usual thing, spiders, which got it completely, drowning, fear of this, fear of that. And then there was this one person who just said, you know what scares the shit out of me? Clowns. And the entire room went, oh, yeah, clowns are creepy. creepy, da, da, da. And they all started like back and forth, oh my god, I can't stand them, and, bah, bah, and they don't know what they're gonna do, and Pennywise and da, 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 da. And I'm like, interesting. So I drew a picture of a clown, and my idea was, well, it can't just be a normal clown, it has to be something like it's either returned from the grave or what have you. I drew a jack-in-the-box and him coming out of a jack-in-a-box, and then I just wrote across the top, here, that game You Don't Know Jack was very popular at the time. And I'm
like, it's still popular. Yeah. I played it all said, weekend.
Scared of the dark? You don't know Jack. And I put a J on the box and an A. And I slid this over to the marketing person. And she's like, what is this? And I was like, oh, there's an idea. And she was like, this is great. Da, da, da. They took that drawing and then they brought us in and they were like, okay, expand upon this. So I did a whole backstory on Jack. And then they said, we want to do a visual. And one of the artists at Universal just said, I want to paint it. And like, great, let's do a painting of it instead of digital manipulation. And he took photos of my face and painted me as the clown. And it just took off. And again, it was that combination. Is a clown terribly original? No, I'm listening to what the people say. Is Jack, like, well, there's great clowns, right? There's Pennywise is not one that comes to mind. But then I was like, but this story is different. And what the combination was is that I had been watching a show called an Autopsy, which was about forensic medicine. And they did a special, just one of the little small little bumpers at the end where they had gone to a carnival graveyard in near Sarasota, right? And they're going through, and it was a BBC crew that was going through and filming all these old things, like going, oh, this is the heyday of when they had spook shows and spooky houses and all that. And the cameraman went by, and there was a body, like a fake body on the wall, and he hit it with his arm, and he hit the leg, and the leg broke. And he looked at it, and there was a bone sticking out of it. So they brought in a group, and they were like, what is this? And is this a real body? And they found out that it was a gangster from New Jersey that they had killed and paper mache'd and stuck him in this thing. And he'd been there for 30, 35 years.
Wow.
And I was like, okay, that is creepy. What if there was a clown in the 40s, you know, during the heyday of traveling circuses, and he would go, and everywhere he went, kids would disappear. So the police were on the trail of him. The carnival owner found out that he was doing it. So the carnival owner and all the other circus performers and carnival performers killed this clown named Jack and stuffed him. His thing is he would perform on a giant Jack's in the Box. They stuffed him in there, sealed it up, and kept it. And they could never find this child killer until a film crew is doing a documentary and looking for research for Halloween Horror Nights. Like, oh, we want to do a carnival theme. And they see this box and they turn to it, and you hear the da-dun-da-dun-da-da-da-dun, and suddenly Jack is released to cause chaos. And, you know, Jack is awesome. I'm so happy that people liked him, that he's still around is fantastic. And it's you know, I also don't want to be like, I am the only one that I came up with the idea, but I didn't paint the painting. I didn't perform it. That guy named James Keaton, it was the guy I hired to perform it, and I directed him, but he got it immediately. And he's one of those guys that's like Lon Chaney. He needs the makeup. He wants to get in the makeup and feel it and how it's on his cheek. And that influences what he's doing. And, you know, Jack is, he's been playing Jack for 30 years, I think now. And there's other guys that are great too, but he's kind of that combination. And a lady named Susan Moore did the costuming, and it just was fantastic. Jim Utenberg did the prosthetics, which to this day, or that clown, when he walked out the very first time, people were like, okay, Halloween Horror Nights just went, they just got serious on us.
We're going to have to take a break in about 5 minutes, but I want to talk about that exact point, because you brought up, like, we've talked before on like the list of people's fears, right? And up there are things like drowning and spiders and stuff like that. But the fact of the matter is, those are not fears that you can easily take somebody through a theatrical moving thing. Yeah, you can have spiders on the ceiling, whatever, and that would freak people out. But that in person is not as scary as something that's a live one or a bunch of them coming over a wall or something, which you can't, you know, even with the best spider trainer in the world, Mark's wife, Carrie, couldn't get the spiders to keep going over the wall every time somebody walked in the room, you know? Yeah.
That's why you watch those old spider movies, like Shatner's Kingdom of Spiders. It's tough to watch because you realize they're literally just got spiders crawling around and he's throwing them everywhere. And I'm like, oh, poor spiders.
Well, you know, spiders. That those movies in the 70s, as much as I love them.
Yeah.
You know, you watch Food of the Gods now and you realize they're shooting rats. Like, they holy were, moly.
Yeah. That's thankfully the ASPCA fixed all that.
Yeah.
But the point is you created something. And I think the difference is with people's help, very little in life is a solo effort, right?
Right.
You know, Mark would like to say this show was a solo effort, but we all know better. I'm teasing you, Mark. But I think what it was fascinating to me is that you did create this backstory and you created this character that could be more well known than, like you said, the people under the stairs. For those of us that saw that, there are several other movies, you know, what is it? Last Turn on the Left or whatever. Some people know what that is, but other people are like, what? But people know who the fuck Jack is. Like, they know.
You know, it's interesting too, because then it was, okay, what do we do next? And we were like, okay, we're going to do a completely different character. And his name was going to be Eddie. And the whole idea was, his tagline was, no more clowning around. which kind of goes, oh, and it was a whole different kind of, you know, clowns very much smile, paint, organic. Eddie was industrial, right? He had a face mask that was bolted into his skin and he had a chainsaw. Unfortunately, September 11th happened. And all of that got, I mean, we were like super sensitive, which we should have been. We should have been. I'm not saying we shouldn't have done that. But again, then all of a sudden it was, well, what do we do? Oh, we know. We'll make Jack Eddie's brother. And I'm like, okay, we can work with that. But I didn't want him to be in the same family as Jack. I wanted him to be his own creation, just like the caretaker is his own creation and has his own story. It's a different movie. But it's interesting, too. One of the other influences for Jack, and not just necessarily Jack, but why I think clowns personally scare me, because I look for, how do you connect something to somebody? Like, how do I connect it? Like, what is that thing? Like you said, spiders, it's creepy. It's coming across the floor. Don't like the way it moves. I don't like the fact that it has mandibles. I don't like the fact it can bite you and some of them can kill you. All these things. But how do I connect you to being terrified of that? Well, for Jack, I started thinking about clowns, and I've never been afraid of clowns. But I remember a movie that stuck in my head that was called The Greatest Show on Earth with Charlton Heston. It's from the 1950s. It's a fantastic movie. But Jimmy Stewart played a clown.
Yep.
And very lovable. Jimmy Stewart, who's one of the most lovable people in the world. George Bailey is playing a clown. But you find out, you never see his face. He's always got the makeup on. And you find out because he's a wanted murderer.
Yep.
So that to me was, as scary as this is, what's underneath the grease paint? What's the mentality? What's in the intent behind a clown? You know, because they can make you happy and smile. But if you look at their eyes, and it can get really, really out there pretty quick.
John Wayne Gacy.
Yeah. You look at some of those pictures and you're like, wow.
Yep.
Entertaining at different things. He did it.
Well, and this distracts you, right? Oh my God. Funny. He's got a painted on smile. He's got a big red
nose.
Right. But his eyes are telling you, I'm going to gut you like a fish.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's true. Okay. We have to take a quick break. Enough with now having the crap reminded of scary clowns. We will be right back after this word from our sponsors.
Prepare to be devoured. The Wolves of Wharton is a 6-part complete book series by Eerie Travels producer Bo Lake. It has been called dark and visceral, steamy, dramatic, and a fresh take on the werewolf mythos. If you like action, adventure, a large serving of body horror, and some steamy relations, the Wolves of Wharton series is for you. Pick it up wherever books are sold. Or at linktree.com/bow_lake.
Greetings, travelers. Now available on Audible and other audiobook platforms, Eerie Appalachia. Join us, won't you, as we discuss creatures like the Poplick Monster, the White Fangs, the Snallygaster, the Wampus Cat, the Lizard Man of Skateboard Swamp, Bunny Man Bridge, and the Ohio Grassman. All these creatures and more await you if you dare listen to Eerie Appalachia, presented by Mark Muncy, History Press, and Four Horsemen Publishing.
Wow. We've been talking the whole break and we went over. So poor Erica is going to have to, and Bo are going to have to do some edits, but it's all good.
Well, now we're back. So I want to ask you, because we could talk literally the entire time about Universal and stuff like that. But my question for you is, and I think you've told me this story, but you haven't told your listeners, what scared the crap out of you first, though? Because, you know, there are people that I feel love monsters because they like that feeling of being scared and the creativity. So what scared the crap out of you first?
That's a great question. And a lot of things, a combination of things that I was a terrified young kid. And I think that's probably why I was drawn to horror, because there's something cathartic about being scared and then surviving. I think that's why most of the great horror movies, you know, it's called like Final Girl. Well, the final girl wins. So you go on the journey with her, right? It's cathartic. It's like people riding a roller coaster. It's terrifying. It's physically terrifying. It is a sensation that causes anxiety, but then you get through it and you're like, I did it, right? It's the whole idea of, I want to slay my dragons. I want to be prepared for my dragons so that I can slay them. So back to your question of what really scared me. Early on, I was scared of spiders because I saw a movie called The Giant Spider Invasion, which is terrible, but it's awesome.
We'll try to put the link if we can find it in
the show. It's a 70s film that had an amazing poster. And, you know, my parents, God love them, were very open with, like, what do you want to go see? What do you want to do? You want that magazine? Sure. You want that comic? I never have a memory of my parents going, I don't know about this, which explains a lot, I'm sure. But also, like, I just think it was a horror movie and I saw this poster and I went to go see it. And then it just messed me up. That and the footage from a show called In Search Of.
Yeah.
The Bigfoot episode of In Search Of, which to this day, Bigfoot scares me. It scares me. The idea of it. And, you know, I've seen Harry and the Hendersons, and that's really nice and that's really great. But the scary thing to me is it's still an animal and a creature that doesn't want to be seen. And, you know, wherever your stance is on believing or not. But what's funny is my first day at Universal as an actor, I walked across the lot and I see Harry coming at me. They used to have a Harry and the Hendersons costume character. So I see flipping Bigfoot cruising across Hollywood Boulevard at me. And I'm like, what is this? You know, luckily I became friends with the person that was doing it and I got used to it. And it's not even now, like I'm not terrified of Bigfoot. I'm terrified of the idea of Bigfoot. And I can put myself in a mindset of what that little kid thought of Bigfoot. Because at that point I was living in a wooded area. It just was like this kind of combination and it connected with me, you know. And for anybody who's ever been in the woods by themselves, you feel like you're being watched anyway, because there are hundreds of things watching you.
Yep.
But, you know, the idea that it's a huge mammoth, 7 to 8 foot tall creature that is probably a carnivore, that's not good.
Yes. No. And I think most travelers do believe in Bigfoot or some version thereof. It's preternatural. We don't know what it is, but it's...
Even then, when it was In Search Of, we also had the $6 million Man episode.
Yep, that did it too.
With Andre the Giant, and it's the only thing that ever kicked $6 million Man's ass.
Yeah.
Is Bigfoot. Later he becomes a friend, and, you know, spoiler for a 50-year-old show, but man, that episode shook me.
Yeah, I agree. I have one of those Bigfoot toys.
Oh, man.
Because it was something I had to have. But I remember when that episode came on and there's a shot. I watched this within a year or two ago. I watched it with somebody and I said, this messed me up. And there's a shot right before they go to commercial where Bigfoot's coming right at the screen and then he leaps and it stops. And you're like,
man,
it's just terrifying. And then there were the movies and the magazines that came out in the 70s. And I bought all of them. And I was great during the day, but then at night, I swear to you, that arm was going to break through my window and come in, and, you know. And it's funny because everybody I used to work with knew I had a somewhat of a thing about Bigfoot. And I don't know if you guys remember this, but I think it was mid-2000s on CNN for about 3 hours, Bigfoot was real. They had
body.
And everybody was coming up to me and they were like, you were right. You were right. You were right. And I was like, I knew it. And then, of course, it became a hoax. But
yeah,
still,
24-hour news cycle.
we keep thinking it's going to happen. And, you know, it's us been waiting from the In Search Of days. We're waiting on Nessie. We're waiting on UFOs. We're waiting on Bigfoot. That's the three.
Oh, UFOs. That's a, don't go down that path right now. Right. So I have a question because you talked about Jaws and I just want to touch on this. Cause then I want to talk about some of your preternatural kind of experiences. Right. But you did the movie behind the movie, so to speak, about Jaws, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I thought was interesting, so one of the first rides I ever went on at Universal was the Jaws ride, but it was the Universal in California.
Mm-hmm.
And not that the Jaws ride wasn't good in Florida, but the Jaws ride at Universal, because it was a studio tour, and I think a lot of people don't realize, like, this originally started off that you got to, the whole point of it was you got to go behind, and there weren't rides, so to speak, necessarily. There was you getting to see the where things were filmed and how they were made. And I remember when the Back to the Future car was brought to Universal Studios, it was like a big deal to really look at this car and see the inside and see the props. And, you know, it wasn't, you're going on to a Back to the Future ride, but the ride for Jaws was, they were like, oh, something, something back lot. And you went over what looked like a bridge with only one railing. And all of a sudden there's a boat that gets pulled into the water.
Mm-hmm.
And then you hear the music and this thing comes, they tip the tram you're in.
Yeah.
And this thing comes up, like, scared the shit out of me as a kid. Like, I was so terrified. And I was terrified to watch that movie because, unlike a lot of monsters, and I'm using quotation marks, travelers can't see, going into the water and being attacked by a shark, especially growing up in California, which I did, was a very real possibility. This is something that can happen.
But it's funny because the connective tissue for you, it makes no sense for there to be a giant great white shark in that lagoon at Falls Lake on the Universal backlot. But they had primed you with that movie so that any body of water, that if that thing came out of any body of water, it got you. How many, I'm one of the kids that would, like, if I were swimming by myself, there was a shark on the other end of the pool and I'd start thinking about it and freak out.
Yeah, because, it's a pool, but you still stayed away. Yeah.
Right. Because Spielberg, what was so brilliant is he put all of the shots with Bill Butler right here at the line of the water that we all see when we get to a certain point. And it's like, you see the top of the water and you realize I can feel what's underneath, but I can't see it. And the fact that there's nothing but a giant mouth that, you know, will hurt, right? The idea of being eaten alive and being bitten and all of that's so primal. So, you know, the fact that you're on a tram going over a bridge and this shark comes out of a lake, it makes no sense, but it still scared the shit out of you.
Well, and that's, I love that you just said that, because that's my point with haunted houses. Like, I understand, I mean, there are haunted houses that Mark and we're about to talk about, Martin's Take Me To, which are a different kind of haunted house, right? But those haunted houses with actors and stuff, smart, logical Erica knows that they're actors and they put on this thing. My lizard brain fucking kicks in though. And when you go, like, the last time I went to Universal, I punched somebody who jumped out in front of me in a Husky mask with a chainsaw, got punched in the face. And mm-hmm. I was like, oh my God, because he jumped out at me. And I was like, bam. And then they're like, you need to leave. And I'm like, I do.
We also, most haunters train our actors to jump from the side so that they can get back out. And usually behind a safety buoy.
He did not get back out. Same thing happened at Busch Gardens particular night, because they had what were called scare zones. So you couldn't walk anywhere without walking past people who were put there to interact and scare the shit out of you. Well, somebody jumped out of a hedge or something. It's a bush or a moving bush. Hashtag regrets that.
Oh, way. You are a prime candidate.
She's the target. That's the problem.
I am the target. Unfortunately, I'm not a target. I'm a, like, come
but
close
so
enough.
Here's an interesting thing that just my philosophy on it. There's startling. There's a startle scare, which works effectively. Or there's a scare, which scares you, but then stays with you long after the thrill or the rush of the adrenaline is gone, then your mind starts thinking about, oh, what if, what if, what if?
That?
Those are the things that I always try to interweave into some of these, into some of these mazes that I've designed, is that, you know, and I used to have so many arguments with the operations folks and the upper management, because they want it to be a numbers game, right? We got to get so many through. So they used to say a thing called boo and skidoo, which I hated.
Yeah.
It's like, no, boo, step back so you're not going to get hit, but stay there so that this person can realize you're stalking them. And in some cases, don't scare at all. Just be in the room. Michael Myers never lunges, right, until the very last moment. But I can tell you, 99% of people, if you put on a Michael Myers mask and coveralls and just stood at the corner or in a hedge, people would be like, no, 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 because of what it represents and the connectivity that they have towards it, you know?
Yeah, so that last day I was allowed to be on property for that. They did take my picture. So just for the record, super not allowed to go back. Been a while. I don't think they'd recognize me, but we went in.
Really, they trespassed you?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
That's fun. That's
awesome. Yeah.
You know, that was a win.
That may have been the second person that got assaulted. So the first time I think they forgave. The second, I hit him really hard. I felt really bad, but don't jump out of a hedge at me. It's like a bad idea.
But you paid them to do this. You know that, right?
I did. Well, and here's the thing: we went through a haunted house that was like sort of a butcher shop. There were hanging bodies with wet bags, which was part of that other thing, which like that stays with you. Like you're pushing yourself past these bodies that, you know, these bag meat is what it's supposed to be or something. Mm-hmm. But your point was there was a person in a wheelchair chasing the group through to get you to move so that more people were going through, right? So if you didn't keep moving forward, this thing started chasing you, right? And I remember there was this very large woman with her son who was a teenager in front of me, very large woman, bigger than me. And she walks into this room and it was supposed to be like a old folks home or something along those lines, right?
Which are terrifying regardless.
Yeah.
So this was a doctor's room, and of course you walk in and then the person's over here in this corner, right? This woman takes one step in and is like, oh, hell no, I'm not. Yeah. She just stops. And this person's chasing. I'm like, you've got to move forward. And she's like, I'm not going anywhere. And I'm like,
that's awesome.
I literally just leaned and pointed, and this thing that looked like it had entrails coming out goes, ah, and she's like, ah. I was like, God. And the doctor,
and see that right there is a win.
That's a log jam, and we live for those. That's a triple kill. We love it.
Yeah.
So it was funny because you could tell the way the room was staged, where the surgery bed was or whatever the hell gurney, all the doctor was going to do is step up. He wasn't going beyond that gurney. Like I could tell, like his entire thing was just to do what you said, come into your presence. Make stuff that hurts, a terrifying person with a cleaver or something. I don't fucking know. But it was terrifying.
You need to go through a haunted maze with me because I love the fact that you can tell where they're coming from. You can like really
knock up set down there.
Because you're the perfect audience, because I will tell you, because I've been in the meetings. Okay, let's put this here, because everybody's going to think that guy's just going to step out. But when he's not, this thing's going to get you from underneath a cabinet. And like, we love you. We design you.
Perfect, other than the physical harm I create for actors. So
let's go back to, you mentioned a wonderful place that I worked at as well, which was Terror on Church Street.
Yes.
And we both worked there, the great Alan Hopps, who runs Dark Hour Haunted House out in Texas. We got to get him on the show at some point. But we all worked there around the same time. I think we just missed each other, you know, in passings. But there was something there. It was like an extra scare that was like something that we can't explain. I like to call it a preternatural presence there.
Uh-huh.
And I think you said at one point, you told me you had an encounter with it.
Yeah.
So
it's funny because I just went through the recollection of this and put myself in that space, because for the upcoming book, Haunter's Tale, the re-release, it's going to be in there, but I'll tell you what it is. I worked at Terror on Church Street from 1992 to like 94. And
up to 92. So
I was so what was great is that it was a nighttime job. You showed up at 6 o'clock. So I would work all day at Universal. Then I'd get in my car and I'd rush to Terror on Church Street, and I'd be there till 1 or 2 in the morning. The people at Terror on Church Street, David Clevenger was amazing. He was an amazing designer, amazing director. So David found me. I was at a theater in Orlando called the Old Mark Tooth Dinner Theater. And he came to see a show, and the director of the show introduced me and said, oh, and by the way, Michael's a horror fan. And he was like, what? And so David and I started talking. He was like, come visit me on Tuesday. I went, and he hired me to do some writing for him, to do some acting, all kinds of stuff. And I'm like, I'm in. I'll whatever you want. So most of the time I was outside of Terror on Church Street. I was something that they called a pitcher. And the pitcher would go up and down Church Street and try to get people to come down, and you would create characters. So it was a lot of fun. Like, I had a character that was very much across, like, what if Jack the Ripper was a vampire? So he had the top hat and the cloak, but he also was a vampire. So that's how he was able to disappear. And, you know, and I would create these different characters. Funny story is, one time the tooth fell out and I immediately had to think on my feet, and I became Snaggles, the one tooth vampire. So a couple of times, though, I loved being in, because, you know, you just sit there in between groups, and I would read magazines or draw or what have you, write. But one night there was a room upstairs called the morgue, and the morgue was basically what sounds like Erica's worst nightmare. It was an industrial green tile room with a bunch of hanging bodies and bags. So you would go, you would come from The Exorcist. It was on the second floor. You would come from The Exorcist and that whole thing, which freaks me out. But you'd go down this hall, and then as you go in, these bags would start moving back and forth, and you'd have to navigate through them to get out. And most people would be backing out, and then your impact would be there, which is your scare. So I was in the room, and you're in this little cubby hole, and you have like a little thing to look out, and you have a microphone that you can kind of taunt people with. So I'm sitting there, and I hear the group go by outside past Exorcist, and they're going. And I'm like, okay. And I went to hit the button to start the bags moving back and forth. And out of the corner of my eye, I see this thing in the room, that little white shape that hops up and starts moving towards the group. And it's actually moving the bags as it's going. At first, I'm like, oh, the Exorcist girl, you know, she was in a white nightgown. I'm like, she must have chased these people into my room, or are she playing a practical joke, or is somebody messing around? So I hit the thing. I go around, and all these people are coming out backwards. They turn around, they see me. And this is one that I think you'd like, because I didn't usually like lunge at people. They would see me, and I was a surgeon with a bloody smock, and I had a cap on, a surgeon's cap, and I would put a hole and bring my hair through and put blood in it so it looked like I had a head wound. And they would turn and see me, and I would just go, 5, 4, 3. And by the time I got to 2, they left. They were running because I just stood there. So they run by me. I scare them. And then I watch them leave. They leave out the exit and then go downstairs to go to another area. And then I turn around, and there's a hallway where you can see back into the morgue. And I see what looks like...
You just give me the heebie-jeebies by you getting the heebie-jeebies. I
don't know. Well, but I see basically a human form. And it's not clear. It's not bright white. It's whitish, right? And I'm looking at it. Your brain tries to go put things together. And I'm looking at it, and the clothes it's wearing doesn't have any seams, anything. And it just, at first I'm like, is he wearing like a unitard, like a skier's outfit? What is that? And then I keep looking, and it's walking across the doorway, and then it turns and looks at me. And I look at its face, and there isn't one. It's just a blur. And it literally is like, what am I looking at? And then it continues on and dissipates into a wall. I honestly, and I'm not easily thrown, I just was like, what just happened? Like, you know, and then you start going, did that really happen? You yeah. All the things your brain's going, no, can't be possible. Can't be possible.
You're dreaming. So
I called on the radio. I was like, hey, I need a break. And I went downstairs and, you know, David had known about things, but never, he always poo-pooed it. But I just saw something and I can't make sense of it. And one of the other guys like, oh, you saw Yellow Man. And I'm like,
well, that's what they told me.
Yeah. I'm like, what is Yellow Man? And the story that I got through having conversations, and here's the other thing. Ever since that time I saw it and I acknowledged it, then I never felt the same at Terror on Church Street. I always felt like something was aware of me.
Mm.
Didn't like that it was aware of me. Didn't like that I was aware of it. So much so, I kind of started pulling away from Terror on Church Street. And one of the last nights I was there, I was playing a Hannibal Lecter kind of character. And you would take this cell bar door and you'd pull it off the hinge and slam it and scare these people. Well, I did that. I put it away. And I started getting that feeling that I got the night I saw the thing. And I'm like looking around. Now I had put the door back. I'm looking around and I'm like, before I know it, I'm on the ground. The door has come unhinged and hit me in the back of the head and gave me a concussion.
Wow.
So I was like, you know what? I think I might be done. And I never went back as a performer. I went through with guests a couple of times. Like I'd take people to go, this is how haunted houses should be, until the place closed and they were having an auction. And I was like, I'm going to go through and just walk. And I swear to you, I walked in and it was like something new. I was there.
It's like, oh, he's back.
And I talked to other people who got the same kind of sensation. It was like, you know, at one point they were going to do a documentary on it, but they didn't.
Yeah.
And we actually shot a short feature before this, before I saw the actual Yellow Man or whatever it was. We shot a short feature there that we were going to sell in the gift shop called Tales from Terror. And the late Mike Accord was the horror host named Mr. Dark. And the first story that we did, I had written it and it was called Full Time. And it was about a kid who loves horror movies and wants to get a job at a haunted house. And he goes in, he's like, I want full-time work. And they're like, well, let's try you out first. So he's like, come back tomorrow. The kid comes back and you come to realize that all the ghouls are real and he is going to be there. You wanted full-time, you got full-time. But there was a shot that we did in the graveyard where this kid's running straight at the camera. We filmed all night, right? The next day we gave the footage to a guy named Hector who was editing it. He was doing post in Tampa and he called us and he was like, guys, did you see what you saw? Like, did you see anything when you were there? And we're like, no. And I still have it. It's terrible because now it's like degraded, but there's a moment where he's running down the hall and it looks again, that same kind of white form, side of a head and an arm looks like it reaches out from the wall and swipes at him and then disappears.
Yep, that thing, I worked there and I did not like working the second floor.
Yeah.
Because it just, you could feel it up there. And that was, you know, I've always been a little sensitive to that stuff. So I was like, nope, I'll stay down here. Good. I'm down here, guys. I'm good at this, at the main room here.
What was the story that you heard of what it was though? Let's do the story real quick.
So there were a couple of combinations. One thing is that the group that originally created Terror on Church Street was a Spanish group, right? They had done it, these kind of horror shows, horror theater shows overseas. And this was the only one that they brought to the States. And then while they were here, they created it. And then David took over probably about 6 months in and kind of showed them, you know, this is more for the American audience. What's funny is they had Anthony Perkins narrating. They brought Anthony Perkins in to narrate the thing. They put a lot of money into it, except in the area of props. They just grabbed props from whenever. They didn't really realize that, you know, these should be scenic props, theatrical props. They actually brought in gravestones from various sources they would buy. They actually had real dirt on the floor in some cases. David cleared all that out. But they saw this thing too, and they're the ones that branded it Yellow Man, because somewhere in the Spanish lore, yellow or the color yellow or Yellow Man is something that is connected to that lore. And then there was another story about it was a kid who couldn't leave because it, I guess the building used to be like a Woolworths or something.
Yeah.
Was and a stock boy had killed himself on the second floor.
Yep.
It was like
that was the one I heard. Yeah. So it was the old Woolworths. And then I guess even when it was early days train station, that area, they said, oh, a stock boy had killed himself.
Yeah.
It was, that was the going story I heard too.
But whatever's there, I mean, they've sent
something in and it,
yeah, well, whatever, they tore the building down and rebuilt it. It's now it's like a bohemian motel bar and stuff. But yeah, no. And what's funny is, you know, in hindsight, you kind of go, well, no wonder the place was so scary. But I'm not going to say it was that. I'm going to say it was the wonderful craftsmanship of David and those people and all the actors that were there. But no, there was definitely something there. There's definitely.
Well, and it seems like, you know, that other thing you're talking about, because we talk a lot about going places or being places where you just go. Like, I went on a ghost tour in Orlando at one point, and they start, I think it's the American Ghost Tours. I have that right. But,
Thing Rappers.
What?
Thing. That's a friend of ours. She's one of the owners.
They started a pub, a haunted bar that has this room above it, right? And it has this spiral staircase that goes up to the second floor. And we're walking around. I have my own experiences. That's a longer story. But I start to, I didn't want to go in the bar. We started outside the bar. And they're like, oh, this is the last part. And they're telling the story, right? And I walked in the bar and I couldn't breathe. Like, it felt thick. And then I'm walking up this spiral staircase. And it literally felt like I was being choked. Like, I literally had to stop. And I'm holding on, and they're like, are you okay? And I'm like, no. And anyway, the whole thing, but like going in there, I think you have that, if you have that kind of perception and that empathy, you perceive those things happening regardless. And then, you know, that part of us that, like me, who's very sensitive to getting the shit scared out of me, right? That's now just exasperated. So like almost every sense is going off. So you have your normal senses, and then you have that whatever empathy sense that's going, there's something fucking here. Of course there's something here. There's Dr. Lecter with his brain coming out of his head. No, yeah, there's something fucking here.
Well, and that was, we talked about Hellview and all that, where fear mongers, these things seem to feed on fear. They actually congregate to these haunted locations, and especially these haunted houses, these entertaining haunted houses. Of course they're going to manifest some of this stuff.
It's maybe free food.
It's exactly. It's the ultimate terror sandwich. So here on Church Street, that's an all you can eat buffet.
Yeah.
So, and that maybe that enhanced this thing. It was something that was already there that got worse, or maybe not, or maybe it's something that was
brought in that brought, who knows? It just,
who knows? That's why we need to study these things at some point. That's why we call it preternatural stuff we don't understand yet. Did we see something? It could have been tricks of our mind. But a lot of people saw it there. A lot of people experienced it there.
Yeah.
Of your mind, it's just, was it manifested or was it something else, like a suicidal stock boy or something like that? Not lessening a suicidal stock boy. But I feel like that's a default a lot of times, is it was a suicide that, you know, whatever.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, I don't know. And, you know, there's a part of me, I would love to go back and find that out, as I just never did, because I knew what I saw. I don't know if it was a stock boy, but it wasn't good. To me, like, if it's a suicidal stock boy, that would be more about being sorrowful and sad. And this was not, this definitely had an energy to it that was not great. It was not good. It was aware, and like I said, it was aware that I saw it, and
it liked to scare people. That was just
it enjoyed what it was doing. That's the feeling that I got. And again, you try to, you know, you tell different people that story and they're like, no, I get it. And other people are like, you sure you weren't? And I'm like, I'm sure I wasn't, but you know what, I also am on a different, we're all on different frequencies sometimes. So,
yep. It's stone tape. Some people see it, some people don't. That's just the way it is. All right, we should
shameless self-promotion time.
Yeah, you've mentioned your new book, so let's start the old book that's going to be new. So
I self-published two books called Haunter's Tale, and the idea behind Haunter's Tale is people that are in the horror business of haunting, makeup, acting, or true ghost accounts are just interested in the horror genre and want to create in that genre. I started with just inviting people that I knew had created some amazing things. And I said, if I gave you page space, what's something that would turn you on as far as horror? Like, I want to hear you, like, have you written something? You want to write something like a brand new piece of fiction? Or do you want to tell the story of a haunt? Do you want to tell a true ghost story? I left that up to them. And then I'll give each contributor an interview. They'll get the same interview that talks about, why do you love horror? What movies do you like? What's your favorite Halloween? All these things that are really cool and kind of like inside the actor studio for haunters. So they did well, but you know, I met Erica and I showed her the book and she's like, Mark introduced us, but you know, and I've been a big fan of Mark's books since they first came out, but she said, okay, let me tell you what you're doing wrong. And she was right.
Right.
She was absolutely right. These were things, this was a passion of mine. I wanted to get these out. So luckily with her help, we're republishing them with a brand new face, new content, rebranding them and releasing them. The first one comes out this year, October 31st. And there'll be several volumes. And again, lots of new content along with the classic content that's in there. And before that, we're launching a Haunter's Tale podcast, which will go further into a deep dive with people that are in the book, some people that aren't in the book, and just kind of across the whole gamut of whether you're a home haunter or a professional theme park haunter or a theater director who directed a great version of Sweeney Todd. It's horror theater, horror storytelling, and why it makes us love it so much.
Well, and it's a lot of behind the scenes and talking to the people I think you don't realize make up the parts of it. Like, I would never go, oh, I wonder who created Jack. Like, you know, instead I run from a fucking scary clown. Right. But, you know, I love that you're able to discuss that and talk about for people who love being scared and love the haunts and all of the different kinds of haunts.
Yeah. No, I absolutely, the reasoning behind it is I get to hear their stories, which, you know, again, anybody that's in this world of storytelling where sometimes it skews a little darker, I'm a fan. First off, I'm a fan of anybody who sits in front of a blank piece of paper and fills it with thoughts. Bless you. Bless you, bless you. You're courageous. But that being said, like, and when those blank pieces of paper make you feel like something's over your shoulder, or that there are creatures in the woods, or that vampires are real, or what have you, whatever your particular horror kink is, bring it on. I'm all for it.
I love that. So when can people start following Haunter's Tale?
So now that we've released when the first volume is coming out, which is October 31st, we're going to start the podcast Memorial Day weekend.
Fantastic.
Perfect.
And I've already got a great lineup of people that have already contributed. There's going to be some really great content. You two kids are going to be on the show in the near future, but it runs the gamut from some amazing actors to some filmmakers to some makeup people to some really, really awesome, awesome, scary people that know how to scare you and love to do it.
That is amazing. So much fun. So travelers, your travels for today that we're going to talk about is one in the show notes. What is your website? How do people find you?
So the website it'll go live right before the podcast at the end of May. It will be HauntersTalesStories.com.
And we'll put that in the show notes. We heavily recommend travelers that you listen to this podcast as well. We have many many other podcasts when we know you have plenty of time. So if you want to learn and hear, and if you're a horror fan, you've got to follow this because it's the inside. And then, of course, we will have our lovely friend back on, but you have to pick up a copy of the first of the Haunter's Tales because I've seen it. Luckily, I have an inside scoop and it's pretty fucking amazing. So absolutely go out and pre-order it. And then we will have him back as we get into further spooky seasons.
Oh, yeah. Like I said, well, during the break, we already came up with another episode we're going to do on some other things. So.
We came up with like four, but yeah, let's try to wrap this one, Mark.
All right. All right. Well, thank you so much again, Michael. It was amazing as always.
You. Thank you for letting me be part of Monster May. The May.
Yeah.
Amazing with.
Oh, God, don't. Don't. I'm putting the brakes right there. You're grinding metal now.
With
grinding
Erica.
Metal.
With Erica.
Yeah, with Erica. With Erica Lance. Come on. It's amazing. All right. But listeners, thank you so much again, travelers. We love you all so much. Thank you, patrons on Patreon, for helping keep the show on the road and helping us do some travels. And thanks again, all of you who join us for our special Listener's Tales episodes online and all that. We just can't thank you enough. It's been an amazing journey.
And one last thing, if you feel like there's something behind you, it probably is.
Yeah, and that's what we'll end on. Late at night, you hear that noise outside. Could be just some wind, could be just a shadow crossing the moon. But when you walk over to that curtain, and you're just about to peek out to see what it is, there's always that moment of hesitation because you don't know what's out there. What could scare you? What could be staring back? And we will see you on the other side.